Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us this week at our virtual water cooler chat. I'm Marissa Reynoso, the marketing manager here at PCI, and with me is Christine Winner, part of our PCI Smart team, and also our special guest, Greg Daly from Citation Healthcare Labels. Today, we're going to be talking to you about labeling text requirements and label strategy. As you know, this is a fundamental area of getting your clinical trial off to a successful start. If you have any questions regarding labeling text requirements or label strategy, please find your way to the chat tool in Microsoft Teams. If that functionality is not working for you, you can always text, iMessage, or WhatsApp me at country code 1-619-613-0808, and we will get to as many questions as we can. With that, Christine, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Amanda. So good morning, and I say Amanda and Marissa. You see, you've already merged into one. So good morning and afternoon to everybody. For those of you who are overseas, I'm sure it's afternoon. As Marissa said, we're going to be talking about label text requirements and label strategy. So the one thing we really find in clinical supply planning that can often be overlooked is preparing our label for our clinical trial. Creating the text that goes onto the material is very important. And if it's not done correctly, there's a risk of either delaying your study start. Worst case scenario, you could cause an NDA to be rejected, or possibly a trial outcome to be called into question if your text is not correct or is not following regulatory requirements. So if we take things back, we'll say the basic purpose of a label, what is a label for? And it's really there to ensure that all patients receive the same set of instructions. So harmonized labels will reduce the potential for variability. And that's really your goal, is you want to try and, you know, establish a fundamental text requirement and be able to carry that through on all of your labels to show that you have consistency. Labels are also used not just to identify the instructions on your container, but labels are also used to facilitate the tracking of any dispensed unit by usually including a unique identification number. Now, technology has changed how we create our labels and track the various clinical supplies. So Greg is with us today to kind of give us a little bit of a background of how the label has changed over the years.
Hi, everybody. I just want to say thank you to PCI, Marissa, Amanda, and Christine for giving me the opportunity to join this call. We figure we'll go, you know, run down a little brief history of really what started labeling in the clinical environment. Obviously, commercial labels have been around for quite some time, and really the change from the initial single panel label to booklets has gone through a lot of iterations. Initially, without IVRS or IRT even, what we were looking at were a lot of multi-panel labels, you know, two and three panel labels that we would actually print, you know, whether the treatment, whether it's an active or a placebo, and then that would be covered with a blinding laminate. So in the event of an adverse reaction right at the site, the director could actually open that up, take a look, ensure that either they're on a placebo, it doesn't have to do with the adverse reaction happening, or they're on a live drug and respond accordingly. So, you know, in the 90s really is when IRT surpassed IVRS systems as computers started to get up and running a little more and the option for that type of technology platform existed. And at that point, I think the world was starting to ultimately become more connected through computers and through the internet. And what that allowed people to do is to easily pass information. So with that, at that point is really when the single panel, the multi-panel, and using things like blinding laminates became less of a need in lieu of using phones and internet to ensure that patient safety was ultimately the first piece, being used. So really, when we look at where we are today, you know, using booklet labels and using the strategy behind booklet labels, ultimately, you know, coming from a more of a JIT standpoint, we're able to label up drug and then ultimately use these IVRS systems to help distribute that drug appropriately.
Okay, thanks, Greg. The next thing I was going to really focus on for today is trying to give you some basic high-level information on label content and some of the regulatory input. So if we look at it from the perspective of a trial is being conducted in the U.S. only, your requirements are fairly simple, and that is to be able to use the U.S. caution statement, which is caution new drug limited by federal or United States law to investigational use. That needs to be on every label. After that, the only real requirement from the FDA is just a statement saying that you cannot make false or misleading statements. You cannot state that the new drug is safe or effective for the purpose for which it's being investigated. So that's really it from a U.S. perspective. And since we know we don't have clinical labels out there that only have a caution statement, obviously we're relying on other regulations to give us information to put on that label. So what you'll see is a high majority of regulatory agencies, I'll say, take comfort from leaning on the EU Annex 13 requirements. So everything is that everything outside of the US is going to have various requirements. I'm not going to get into the detail of country by country because we are limited in time. And to be honest, since regulations change all the time, you really need to have a strong regulatory organization or hire a strong CRO with that regulatory capability to research every country that you're going into and be able to provide you the correct information of what is required from a local perspective on that label. But the high level is that most organizations are going to lean on Annex 13. So what is Annex 13? And you may even be hearing about Annex 6. So Annex 6 and Annex 13 are very basically the same thing. Annex 13 came first. It was a directive. And then more recently, Annex 6 came out as part of the EU clinical trial regulation. So technically, you could say that Annex 6 is law. It's like the first was more of a suggestion, and now it's a law. And the main differences that Annex 6 brought into the table is real refined requirements on the period of use. You have the statements you can use are only expiry date or retest date. Before you had some exceptions or some ways to kind of get out of that, and now you can't. So the expiration date or retest date must be on every container from meaty container to all outer packaging containers. So as I said, you need to have a strong regulatory organization. They're going to be your resource for if you're conducting a global trial. They're your resource to be checking into the in-country requirements and, you know, just making sure that, you know, as I could use as an example, Germany, you have to have a local, your address on your label. You can't use a sponsor name and address from the United States on a German label. It needs to be an organization that's in country and it's local. So that's just one example. So really heavily lean on your regulatory organization. If you're hiring a CRO, really lean on them and make sure that they are truly performing their responsibility to be sure that they're getting you the correct information.
Christine?
Yes.
We have a question from the audience. Someone is curious about, has anyone done just-in-time labeling for global studies? When you do so, where the protocol number, expiry date, and EUDRACT number are on an auxiliary label attached to the carton only, where are those supposed to be?
All right, hold on, I'm looking at this. Has anyone done just-in-time for global studies? So it sounds like you're talking about if you created a pooled supply, if you have a clinical supply for, you want to use it for multiple trials, you could leave the protocol number blank or leave a space for a protocol number, and the same for your DAC number. And you could provide or you could perform just-in-time labeling at the time of either either right at the time of distribution, or you're going to actually pull in a packaging activity for a defined amount of product and apply a label to it. So it certainly could be done. And I'm assuming that's what you're talking about. It's in regards to if you're using pooled supplies.
Yeah, I just want to add to that, Christine, from the label perspective, what, you know, a lot of the times what we typically try to do is create an inventory of the static booklet information. And just to give you kind of like, I'm just going to throw numbers out there from a cost perspective, but then also follow up with the timing side of things. So let's just say you've got five campaigns and you're going to be running 10,000 labels in each campaign. Now, if you manufacture all that static inventory up front, and I'm just throwing a number out here, you know, that 50,000 booklet labels may cost something like $50,000, let's just say. Now, if you run each one of those booklet campaigns separately, you've got five manufacturing runs. So you've got the full timeline of a booklet manufacturing run, not just the timeline of the smaller timeline of an auxiliary run, but then you're also looking at increasing that total cost by close to five times that, maybe four or five times that at that point. So from the perspective of the labeling side of things, that auxiliary label, you know, most of the time the UDRAC is going to probably be hard-coded on the cover of the booklet, since that won't change in the ultimate protocol of that study. But then when it comes to the lot and the expiry itself, and any randomized coded information, then that could be easily be printed on an auxiliary label and dispatched, obviously, from us to PCI for the packaging component to be done. And usually that timeline is about half of the timeline of a booklet manufacturing run. So rather than that 6 to 8 week timeline, let's just say, you know, you may be more in the 2 to 3 weeks on any one of those future campaigns. So it definitely makes sense from the cost and the timing perspective to consider purchasing bulk inventory up front. Now, I know the question always arises when that happens, you know, well, what if I want to add a country, or what if I want to, you know, not use a country? When it comes to adding or simply omitting, it's always best up front to include all potential countries and languages that you may potentially, you know, distribute that product in. If you think about the way that a booklet is manufactured, it's actually three layers. So you've got your base label, and that's really what adheres to your primary or secondary packaging. You've got a leaflet inside of it, which is ultimately all the pages and the contents of the text. And then you've got a top laminate over the top of that. Now that insert is really comprised of a single sheet of paper that's folded and glued. So, you know, you can't really open a booklet and necessarily add another language, which is some question that we get quite frequently. So from the planning stage, it makes sense to really add in any potential language or country that you're going to use.
Did that answer the question?
That's good. Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we're talking about booklet labels, one of the other things that's very important to think about is translation. So you're going to want to establish a core label that's in English first. And then with that, you need to be able to satisfy all of the Annex 13 requirements. So essentially you have 12 items in the list. I don't think I need to go through the 12 items because it's very easily and readily accessible on the internet. You can just do a quick search for it. But make sure you've truly satisfied all of the requirements of Annex 13. Don't leave anything out because you will get stopped. You know, some countries in particular will be very, you know, very strict on that. So once you have your base label, then you want to be able to get that translation done. Now there's some companies that hold their own a translation database where they'll have key phrases that are pre-translated, and then they'll use those to kind of cut and paste and create, depending upon what extent of languages they have and what countries they're going to, they might be able to establish a booklet label template based on their own information. For the most part, though, you're going to either rely again on your CRO or you're going to hire out to a translation service to get that core English-based label translated into each of the countries. And then that the next level of that responsibility is that within that country, they need to be able to provide a certification that the translation is correct and accurate, and it does meet their local regulations. When you're able to get all of those certifications for each of those countries, it's after that that it goes back to a vendor such as Greg's at Citation to start creating the booklet label. I mean, Greg already went through the different layers of the booklet. But that, you know, just kind of telling you, you have to get, make sure you're getting that certification. It's, you know, you don't want to take that risk to say that, you know, you can just, you know, don't use Google Translate. Don't think you can just kind of create it on your own and put it out there because it's, oh, it's not that hard. And then, you know, you want to be able to make sure you can rely on having that correct translation, make sure that they are providing the local regulatory guidance and providing you that certification that's going to back you up when you're doing your filing.
And I think an important piece of that too, Christine, is, you know, in the past, we used to dabble in this a little bit, but the idea of getting a second review for subjective errors by a native speaker is really paramount, especially when you're considering you know, character languages. A lot of the time when it comes to even setting text in a booklet, breaking a sentence and coming down to the next line can change the intent of what's being said. And that's an important piece ultimately that we don't think about in the English language, because obviously we can break a sentence anywhere and we just keep reading it. But the content and the intent of what's being said can ultimately change dramatically. And I'll give you an example. We were working on an African study, and, you know, basically the language said something of young adults, right? This is for nobody below the age of young adults. But in that country, there were three definitive separations in who is considered a child, a young adult, and a full, you know, adult. So by having that language just slightly wrong, and something that we would think of, you know, don't give this to a child, right? It inadvertently had basically cut out 80% of that patient population that they were trying to get into by something as silly as just the content and the intent that they speak in that particular part of the world. So that second review is paramount.
Yeah. I think we have a question from Yvonne.
Yeah, we do. Do label requirements differ based on what phase of clinical trial you're in?
I will say I would not expect it to. If you're looking at the Annex 13 or Annex 6 guidelines, there's no differentiation telling you that for phase 1 trials or phase 2 trials, do this, and phase 3 trials, do something else. It's really just a basic requirement of what has to be on the label for identification purposes. So I would take the full requirements at face value and say this is what needs to be on the label for every study. I mean, your variations on your requirements are that you could possibly be leaving off. You know, if you're in the U.S., you may not need to have an expiration date unless you're reconstituting a product, then you do need to have an expiration date on there. Keep out of reach of children, if your protocol is specific for in hospital and they're not taking it home, things like that don't have to be on the label. But many companies will also still use the keep out of reach of children, even if they know it's in hospital, just to check the box. One thing that's interesting is I actually had a discussion with our QP this morning on a different topic, and if you look at the regulations, it's going to tell you. So if we shift the focus a little bit to your ancillary materials that might be accompanying a clinical trial, like perhaps you're supplying some rescue medication and you need to label that, the regulations will tell you that if it's an approved trial medication, you really don't have to do anything to it to label it. What I learned today is that's not the case. So I thought that was very relevant timing to bring to today's discussion. The advice right now is follow Annex 13 requirements for everything, whether it's we know to do it for investigational material. If it's an authorized medicinal product, use it for that too. use it for everything. Follow the full, check the box, check off everything on Annex 13. Make sure that's all on your label. Even creating a booklet label for your rescue medication and making sure you have a translation of it in for every country. But he had indicated to me that despite what the regulations show, many countries are kicking it back and they're not allowing you to use their drug in their country. So he said his advice is just check the box, get everything that's from Annex 13 on there.
We have another question from Michael. In the EU or Australia, are there any restrictions for over-labeling, say, to extend the expiry date?
So I know for both in the EU and Australia, you have an opportunity to over-label. You have to create a label that will line out the batch number, rewrite the batch number and line out the previous expiry date and then put the batch number with the new expiry date. So you are putting it alongside. You need to be able to see the previous text, but that's why they're using a label that will be able to line it out and show the cross out of the original expiry dating. And then you repeat the batch number with the new expiration date.
Okay.
I think it's a good point too to bring up that that's a great piece of information to communicate, you know, to the PMs if there's the anticipation of expiry updating being a significant factor. If that's something that you know is going to happen, then when it comes to the design, just from the labeling side of things, then that can be taken into consideration to ensure that there's space to do so. I know obviously a lot of the time, you know, we're all labeling and packaging small vials and one by cartons and things like that these days. So every little bit of text real estate becomes very, very important. So that communication line being open, I think is really good for the overall success of that trial.
Okay. We have another question. If the investigator has to fill some data on a multi-page label, should it be done on the first page or in the local language page? I'm assuming this is for a multi-page label. I think he means a booklet label.
Right. So for a booklet label, I would say they're going to be turning to their page of their local language, and they would be filling it in their language on their page. So while Greg was talking about extending the expiry date, and that was one of the questions, and that's something really to think about now with the new Annex 6 restrictions. So before, you were able to take your extended expiry date and just label, let's say you had a blister card in a carton, or maybe you have a rescue medication, a bottle in the carton, and you could label the outside of the carton and be done with it. You can't do that anymore. So you have to label all the way down to the immediate container and make sure that the immediate container bears the expiration date or the period of use. So when planning for that, and when you're planning your packaging runs, you want to be able to keep that in mind. If you know that there's a high probability you're going to be having to extend your expiration date, you're still accumulating your stability data. You only have maybe 18 months, you know, you're going to be maybe adding another 6 months, maybe you're going to be doing this on a regular basis. So there's a couple options or solutions you could be looking at on this. One could be as simple as trying to minimize the layers of packaging. If you have a bottle into a carton, into another carton, try not to have that many layers, because every layer is going to have to get opened and labeled. If you have a blister and seal it into a card, then usually your card is going to be your immediate container, and that can get the expiry dating labeled. But if you put that card into another carton and then again continue to add tertiary layers, that's adding more risk as you have to go back and then relabel all the way down to the immediate container. Tamper sealing. So we all love the tamper seal, but if you have to then relabel, now you're having to open a tamper seal, relabel, and either re-tamper seal or re-carton, depending upon the availability of your material. So, you know, think about trying to plan your supplies. If you know you're going to be getting into expiry date extensions, try and minimize the layers of packaging that you have. Try and avoid tamper sealing on multi-level packaging if you can. If you have a small product like an ampoule or a syringe, consider using a flag label. And Greg can probably talk a little bit more about a flag label because it'll give you a little bit more room to work with.
Yeah, so the idea basically, there's a couple different options there that kind of fulfill the same task. And ultimately, it depends on probably the size of the run and whether or not you're using automated equipment for any application. Obviously, in the clinical world, that doesn't necessarily happen quite as much as the commercial world. But the idea with a flag label is just to design a label where if you were to look at the liner behind it, you'd have a backslit in the liner at one portion so that you can peel off only a portion of the liner and use that exposed adhesive to be applied to whatever that CTM is that you're packaging and labeling. Now, the remainder that still contains the liner, the remainder of the label that contains the liner, would then just wrap around and either be rubber banded or just wrapped and placed into a carton. So the alternative to something like that would be something like a multi-adhesive label that would have three sections, you know, a permanent, a deadened area in the center that had no adhesive, and then a removable section so that you could cleanly wrap around and then that would adhere to itself. And it works kind of like a booklet would, where it can be opened and closed multiple times. It's really just a matter of the timing on it, since one takes a little longer than the other, I would say. But from a performance standpoint, there's always options there, right? There's always a couple different avenues to take in terms of trying to pick up more text real estate, especially on these, again, these smaller CTMs that we seem to be using these days.
So we have, I know we only have 3 minutes left, but we do have quite a few, we have three more questions. So Christine, Greg, I know you have a few minutes extra, so we can stay on for maybe 10 more minutes just to get to everyone's questions. Mike has a very interesting scenario for us to consider. India requires the date of manufacture on the label. How do you list the date of manufacture for a blinded product when the active and placebo have two different dates of manufacturers?
That is a good question. I mean, I honestly, I personally have not had to manage a label where I've had to record a blinded date of manufacturer. I mean, we've done expiry dating where you take the shortest date for to be able to blind it. I think I'd probably have to research that and be able to come back with some type of a response to that, because aside from using some type of a code and the traceability, I'm not as familiar with an India I'm not really familiar with that requirement from India. Sorry.
And then we have another question. From your experience, do clients normally create a cover page for the booklet label and submit it to the regulatory bodies, or is it standard practice that PCI generates the cover page?
So you're talking about the English label?
Yes.
The fundamental. So if we're talking about, I'm sorry, Marissa, I'm asking you as if it's your question.
I'm feeling the answer is yes.
Feeling the answer is yes.
This is probably in regards to a booklet label ultimately. So,
yeah,
you know, that once you have your English text and you've got the translation and it's, you know, passes regulatory at that point, typically the front cover can either be left blank. A lot of people will like to include information like the sponsor company name, the UDRAC number, you know, sponsor address, things like that, potentially a table of contents. From what I've seen on my end, and again, keep in mind, I'm not a regulatory body. We just look at a lot of labels, obviously. You know, there's nothing that particularly has a guideline around what needs to be on the cover. It's more about the approved text inside of it.
Okay. And then some countries require that we add the expiry retest date to a label. What strategy do you recommend for extending the retest date during the study? Do we have to relabel all of the products?
So there's a good question that you have options of, you could try and limit your packaging campaigns so that you're only labeling a small amount of stock with the current retest or expiry date that you have. And then as you get your, get your stability information, you can then run another packaging campaign with an extended date. So that way you're holding the stock level at your supply chain to avoid the need to do extension relabeling. You've got just-in-time labeling that you can do. You can either do that at the depot if you're holding your supplies back. You could verify whether your site or your CRO has your has the capability and the procedures in place to possibly label the extended dating at the site itself. So you do have a couple of options.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Christine and Greg. I think this was a very helpful session. If I can ask everyone to direct your attention to the screen, just a few announcements regarding the next few water cooler chats. So moving forward, in general, we are going to be moving to one water cooler chat every 2 weeks. And we've gotten a lot of requests to move away from the Thursday date as well. So while we will still be doing these chats on Thursdays, we will also be doing some on Wednesdays. And towards the end of the year, we also have one that's on Tuesday. So please make sure to check the date and time of the water cooler chat so that you can join us. And you will always receive a confirmation email 24 hours before the chat and 2 hours prior to the chat. So you can also look to those as your reminders, and we'll also send you a calendar invite as well. In 2 weeks, right before us and the states go off for Labor Day weekend, Christine's colleague Laurel Ferenschick and our partner Mark Lisi from Savota will be back to talk to us about optimizing IRT for clinical supply management. I hope you'll join us for that, especially with everything that's happening in the world with COVID. Savota does have quite a few new features that they would like to share with you. So I hope you'll join us for that one. You can, if you have not registered for that, you can go to pciservices.com/water. And if you are interested in listening to this chat with Greg and Christine again, by end of next week, we will have that recording available on our water cooler chat resource page. You can go to pciservices.com/water-cooler-list, and there you'll be able to access most audio recordings from the water cooler chat series along with some white papers. Thank you very much for joining us this week around our water cooler, and we hope to see you again soon. Thanks, Christine. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.